Good morning. This is the International Symposium John Rawls, Centenary of John Rawls, the 15th anniversary of Theory of Justice, held in Girona, and with the Càtedra Ferrater Mora, Universitat de Girona, Universitat Pompeu Fabra, Barcelona, Universitat Autònoma de Barcelona, and Universitat de Barcelona. We are on the second day in panel 8 online, and we have with us Lucas Fuchs from the UCL, the University College London, and the title of his presentation is The Difference Principle and State-Led Growth. We have also with us Andrew Van Hong, from the Hong Kong Polytechnic University, and he's going to talk about roles and religion and public reason from a hermeneutical perspective. And finally, Takuto Kobayashi, Waseda University, and the title of his presentation is Justice as Fairness on the Justification of Political Procedure. They are going to present their presentations, and then at the end, we are going to have the discussions. So please, Professor Lucas Fuchs, start. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak here today. I'm interested in the difference principle and Rawls's thought and the political, economic, institutional implications. So what kind of institutions do we need to realize the difference principle? And here I engage with a debate that puts growth at the center. There are a couple of theorists who argue that growth is the best strategy in order to satisfy the difference principle. And I will engage with their debates, or the political philosophical debates, as well as some recent arguments in the field of political economy as to how best to realize growth. And as you can see from the title of my talk, I believe that we need to have an account of the state-led growth in there. So this, I think this has relevance for the recent revival of thinking on property-owning democracy, and as I said, the institutional implications of Rawls. So let me get started. I think you will be familiar with the difference principle. It's the second part of the second principle of justice in Rawls' theory of justice, and then justice as fairness. For Rawls, social and economic inequalities must be to the greatest benefit of the least advantaged members of society. That's a core principle. That's what makes Rawls's theory an instance of egalitarianism. And so in other words, he thinks that such inequalities are only justified to the extent that they benefit the least advantaged members of society. So there is this strong concern for the weakest, the least advantaged in society. The interpretation, the consequences of this principle took a very big proportion of the debate on Rawls. One aspect that has received comparatively little attention was growth, and that's part because of Rawls himself. In his 2001 Justice as Fairness, Rawls rules out that the difference principle requires continual economic growth. There are a couple of quotations like this in the book, but this is representative. We do not require continual economic growth over generations to maximize upward indefinitely the expectations of the least advantaged. That would not be a reasonable conception of justice. Instead, we should not rule out Mill's idea of a society in a just stationary state. So here he refers to John Stuart Mill's idea of a stationary state. That means there's no economic growth. We have a set of technologies for means of production in an economy, and there is no more growth in this society. So Rawls thinks that is at least compatible. Such a stationary society is compatible with his normative principles. So I have a, very basic schema that I will use in order to map where the debate is going. The first line should demonstrate that for Rawls, growth is not a satisfactory strategy. It's not a satisfactory means towards fulfilling the difference principle. But as I mentioned at the beginning, there are a couple of writers who disagree with Rawls on what his principles imply. Jason Brennan in 2007 argues that if Rawls only applied his own principles consistently, he would hold that growth is the best strategy for satisfying the difference principle. If you want to maximize over time in the long run the prospects of the least well off, the growth gets us to more wealth in society, more income and wealth, one of these primary goods and roles. And if you then make sure that the least well off get their share in this growth, then the difference principle requires nothing else than growth as institutionally enshrined in a society. And John Tomasi in Free Market Fairness spells out this idea and argues that also other other principles of justice in Rawls can at least moderately be, they at least somehow require growth, or the growth will help us satisfy them. Maybe they are not the only way towards satisfying them, but Tomasi extends this idea and puts it at the basis of a whole set of political economic regimes that he thinks are compatible with Rawls's account. Why do these thinkers exactly think that growth will satisfy the difference principle? Here we have to think of the debates regarding property-owning democracy. So Jason Brennan believes if you have, Jason Brennan wants you to imagine a comparison. On the left-hand side, you have a laissez-faire regime, a market-based laissez-faire regime with minimal interference by the state. And on the right-hand side, you have something like Rawls's property-owning democracy, where there is some redistribution, or as Rawls would say, predistribution. There are mechanisms to ensure that wealth is not accumulated, and so on. And so if we start in the year 1900 in both economic regimes, you see that the laissez-faire regime is much more unequal. The rich have a wealth of 40, which is four times as much as the poor. And if you compare this to the continual redistribution scheme, the property-owning democracy regime, the poor are somewhat richer and the rich are significantly poorer. So the gap between the poor and the richer is much smaller in the continual redistribution regime. But Brennan thinks the fact that there is such interference in the property-owning democracy means that there is less growth. We can expect less economic growth in that regime. And he thinks that in the laissez-faire regime, we can expect growth rates of 4% per year. These are just arbitrary numbers. And in the property-owning democracy, he expects 2% per year. And if you then run this through in the year 1901, all the income groups, the poor, the middle, and the rich, their income sees a 4% or 2% growth. So the poor earn 10.4 in the laissez-faire regime, or 20.8 for the middle income group. And in the continual redistribution scheme, there is a somewhat less growth. So this is in the year 1902, 1925. After 25 years, you can see that the poor in the laissez-faire regime, they get 26.7, they are already richer than the poor in the redistributed regime. So while in the redistribution regime, the poor have benefited from initial redistribution, they overtook the poor in the laissez-faire regime because of growth rates. And then after 50 years, the poor in the laissez-faire regime are richer than the rich in the continual redistribution scheme. So you have 71 for the poor in 1950 compared to the 64 for the rich in the redistribution scheme. And then after 100 years in the year 2000, the laissez-faire regime much, much richer. And the poor are three times as rich as the richest in, or as the rich in the redistribution scheme. So Ross Brennan thinks that the least well-off, the poor, incomparably are much richer than everybody else in the other regime. So it looks like if we have such a strong concern for the least well-off in society, we should do whatever we can to ensure growth rates. So that's why I want to flag here, the right-wing Rawlsian critique argues that growth is not only a possible, but is the best way of satisfying the difference principle. And as I already highlighted, the economic, the political, economic, institutional upshot of this argument is stronger reliance on the market and aversion against state interference against that into the market. So Jason Brennan says, interference requires interrupting the information, the learning structure of the market. And so we disrupt the equilibrium, less efficiency and less growth. So this argument from the difference principle to growth is for these authors also an argument from growth towards the market. I think one of you isn't muted. Maybe you could check that you're muted. Thank you. So now we have a full argument from the difference principle towards market-based or even market fundamentalist political regimes. And that is a very significant argument, because usually you might think the difference principle is the bastion for left-wing arguments. If you think there is a requirement for the state to be heavily involved in the political economy to ensure redistribution, to ensure that outcomes aren't too unequal, then you need to have some role of the state in political economy. And this argument by the right-wing Rawlsians turns this argument around and states that if anything, the difference principle requires for us to not interfere with the market. So we have more growth and a better position for the weakest in society in the long run. That is the argument as it is in the literature. I want to ask some questions, show some alternatives, and ultimately establish a very different political economic regime that might be the result of this kind of philosophical argument. The first question I want to ask is, what kind of growth is beneficial for the least well-off? Or slightly differently, what is it about growth that makes it attractive to society and to the least well-off in society? I think what's interesting about growth is the innovation aspect in it. And with innovation here, I mean new technology, but more importantly, the introduction of new products, new ways of producing, new ways of selling into the market. So I'm relying here on Joseph Schumpeter's account of innovation as new economic possibilities, new combinations. So let's ask, what makes growth desirable for the least well-off in society? I want to argue as an intermediary step that what money can buy, the wealth, the value of your wealth, depends on the state of technology in a society and on the state of markets. And I think a very good comparison in order to understand this point is if you compare a typical philosophy graduate student in Western Europe, who earns a modest stipend with Mansa Musa, who was the king of Mali in the 13th and the 14th century, and allegedly the richest man in history. Mansa Musa owned all the gold, or half of the gold in the old world, and gold was, fetched a good price at that time already. And when he went to the pilgrimage to Mecca and Medina, he went through Egypt and handed out some gold to poor people there. And by doing that, he He caused massive inflation, and the monetary system of Egypt broke down, and it took them some 10 years to recover. That's how rich this man was. So Mansour Musa was extremely rich, and a typical PhD student like me, I don't have anything like Mansour Musa's wealth. But there are some things that I'm able to do that Mansour Musa is not able to do. For example, even with my modest stipend, I'm able to save up some money and buy a new smartphone, let's say. Or I can book a flight from the Netherlands, where I'm at the moment, to Spain. Or I could fly over the Atlantic and go to a conference or on a holiday to Florida. These are all possibilities that Mansour Musa didn't have. So it looks like even though I have less gold, I have less money than Mansour Musa, but given the new state, given the new technologies and markets present in society in my age, I'm able to do much more things with my money than Mansour Musa. And so it seems the value of income and wealth, the value of this primary good of income and wealth, rose over the last centuries, and it rose because of innovation, because of new things in the market. So I think when we think about growth, we shouldn't just think of growing the pie in order to redistribute it, but we have to think of the state of technology, the state of innovation, the state of markets that determines the value of our income and wealth. So why is this relevant? I think it's not just PhD students who benefit from these new markets, from innovation-led growth, but also the weakest in society. If you think about the sanitary situation for most people after the Second World War in Western Europe, few had access to bathrooms. Electricity was relatively recent, and that changed basically for everybody. It changed except for the very, very bottom of society who do not have access to that. People who are unemployed or people who are not able to benefit from many of the advantages of living in a society, they still have access to sanitary institutions in a way that was not possible some 70 or 80 years ago. And so it looks like this innovation-led growth changes what the value of income and wealth for people, but it also improves the situation of the least well-off in society. So I would like to specify that when we think about the difference principle, we shouldn't just think of growth as any kind of growth, growing the pie, but innovation-led growth. And then the next question is, who drives growth? What are the kinds of institutions or institutional arrangements that are most suitable for producing growth? And given that we specified that innovation seems to be really attractive in growth, who produces innovation? And there is a debate in political economy going on. Who is it that, what kind of circumstances produce real innovation? It's not just gradual improvements, but real innovation, really new products. And Deirdre McCloskey, a prominent American economist, argued that what made growth attractive, and she thinks it's the market that produced it, what makes growth attractive are such novelties as chat travel, vitamin pills, and instant messaging. And she induces them as arguments, and John Tomasi, one of the right-wing Rawlsians, quotes her on this. She credits the market with all these innovations. And I would like to ask some questions about this. I'm not too sure about this. It looks like when we just look through these three examples, we can identify a significant role of the state in generating all these innovations. For example, the vitamin pills are the outcome of basic research and development in investments in the US and in the UK. It was a research institution, an agricultural research college in the US in the 1920s that led to the research that made us realize, there are vitamins, which are different from proteins and carbohydrates and fats. There are vitamins. And in the 1930s, in a research institute in London, a researcher called Casimir, I don't know the surname now, he discovered vitamins as such, gave them the name, and soon afterwards it was quite easy for private market producers to produce what we now call vitamin pills. Another example is chat travel or instant messaging. Here, there's a famous argument recently in political economy advanced by the economist Mariana Mazzucato that the US military complex played a very significant role in bringing about these new innovations. Everything that makes your smartphone smart doesn't come from Steve Jobs, he just put it together, but from the US military. Take internet, GPS, Bluetooth, everything that is at the core of instant messaging. All these technologies were developed by the US military and associated research and development think tanks. And so this gave rise to this term of the entrepreneurial state as driving, which sees the state as driving an important role here. And a similar argument can be advanced for car ownership. So John Tomasi, whom I mentioned, is the one of the right-wing Rawlsians who think that it's the market that produces growth. He cites that Americans had one car per person, one car per every 4.4 persons in 1938. That grew to 2.4 in 1960, and one per 1.26 by 2003. So car ownership rose massively in the United States, and he thinks that's due to market-based processes. But here I would like to just mention Carlota Perez, who has also thought about the role of the state in innovation and how it has the implementation period. And she argues that it was the welfare state that has allowed things like increased car ownership, because only free education, healthcare, labor union secured salaries, progressive tax structure, and so on, they made it possible for growing numbers of the population to aspire to a suburban home and a new lifestyle. So this American way of life, owning your own home, a car, driving to the supermarket and storing produce in your refrigerator. All this was possible, not because of the innovation and making these things cheaper, but by also looking at the demand side, by giving consumers the stability to make these investments, take on a loan to afford these consumer goods. And so the argument can also be extended to car ownership. It's only because we had, or some countries had such a welfare state that guaranteed consumers a relatively stable life. It's only because we had cars and traffic codes and so on that we could really implement car ownership on a large scale. So coming back to my scheme, I wanted to criticize the right-wing Rawlsians who think that the argument from the difference principle and growth results or implies a market-based or market fundamentalist regime where there's minimum interference by the state. And I wanted to twist that argument somewhat and argue that we need to focus on innovation-led growth. And if we look at previous historical instances of innovation, we realize that the story was different from what they assume. It's not just blind market processes, but it's often a very strong role of the state, be it as an entrepreneurial force, be it in the form of the welfare state, that allowed this kind of growth. There's another slide that I can mention. It's about Schumpeter and creative destruction. And I think that we shouldn't forget another role of the welfare state, namely making sure that these big cycles in society don't hurt the least well off, but I won't go into that into detail. So thank you very much. I hope that was clear enough, and I'm looking forward to the other two presentations and your questions at the end. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lucas. Now we have the second presentation, It's Andrew Van Hong, and it's the title is Roles of Religion and Public Reason from Hermeneutical Perspective. So please, Professor Wong, go ahead.
Can you see the PowerPoint?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Okay. Welcome, everyone. I'm going to present this Roles on Religion and Public Reason from Hermeneutical Perspective. Basically, I will read the PowerPoint. It's quite comprehensive, I think. In democratic societies, moral ideal requires that political decisions and legislation should be acceptable or justifiable to each individual's viewpoint. However, in the face of the fact of pluralism, people with different religious, philosophical, or political doctrines are very difficult in forming such political consensus. Rural states, citizens realize that they cannot reach an agreement or even approach mutual understanding on the basis of their irreconcilable comprehensive doctrines. While John Rawls attempts to integrate religious reason into his political liberalism, he demands that citizens should express their political opinions by using public reason to replace their irreconcilable comprehensive doctrines. According to Rawls, public reason is independent of different comprehensive doctrines. It's also the standard by which we measure laws and political institutions. Rawls argues that religious or non-religious reasons may be introduced in the public political discussion, provided that political reasons are presented that is enough to support whatever the comprehensive doctrines introduced are said to support. This is based on the criteria of reciprocity, which requires that when those terms are proposed as the most reasonable terms of fair cooperation, those proposing terms must also think it at least reasonable for others to accept them as free and equal citizens and not as dominated or manipulated or under the pressure of an inferior political or social position. While one's life is guided by one's comprehensive doctrine, one's political conception of justice should be freestanding, informed by public reason. However, Rawls' position has been much criticized by accommodationists as well as exclusivists. Accommodationists criticized Rawls' proviso as being too exclusive of religions. It excludes religious reasons from the justification of political authority and public deliberations. For instance, Nicholas Waterstaff argues that many religious persons believe that they should base their decision concerning issues of justice on their religious convictions. Rawls' rejection of religious reason in political deliberations is infringing the free exercise of their religion. Even though Jürgen Habermas is not an accommodationist, he also argues that empirically many citizens cannot separate their political stance that are expressed in religious language from those expressed in secular language. As Habermas states, many religious citizens would not be able to undertake such an artificial division within their own minds without jeopardizing their existence as pious persons. Melissa Yates calls this the split identity objection. Rawls' proviso assumes that a religious person should have two sets of rationality, religious and political, that both are mutually independent of one another. Indeed, both involve moral judgments, which grants one's justifications for their political views. However, only political justifications by public reasons would be endorsed, while the justification based on one's basic moral religious convictions, which are essentially to one's very self, are blanket and thus annihilated. Thus, Yates, as well as Stephen Carter, Michael Perry, and Andrew Murphy, also criticized Rawls' proviso for failing to give due respect to the significance of comprehensive doctrines, in particular for those religiously based. It places an unfair obligation on religious citizens to divide themselves into public and non-public selves. Furthermore, according to Habermas, Rawls' proviso seems to put an asymmetrical burden on religious citizens. While religious citizens are required to translate their religious viewpoints into public reason, secular citizens have no such demand. As Yates argues, while reasonable non-liberal comprehensive doctrines are not admissible in political discourse, liberal comprehensive doctrines may sometimes be treated as neutral. Public reason would in practice constrict the liberation of only some people. In response to such criticism, Tom Bailey and Martina Gentile defends Rawls and reminds us that First, Rawls restriction applies only to the particular important public political forums, such as discourse of judges, government officials, and candidates for public office, and issues such as the consideration of certain constitutional essentials. This leaves a wide range of other liberations unrestricted in the non-public background culture of society, such as civil society. Second, religious reasons may be employed as long as they can be provided in due course. Third, Rawls encourages non-religious person to reason from a religious perspective or from a comprehensive perspective of comprehensive doctrines that are not one's own, through reasoning by conjecture and to show how they might support the shared conception of political authority. Fourth, the restrictions apply only to religious reasoning. It leaves no room for other ways of expressing religious and other comprehensive doctrines. Fifth, Rawls exclusion of comprehensive doctrines applies not only to religion, but also to non-religious secular ones. Rawls' proviso does not discriminate against religious persons. He considers all comprehensive doctrines as equally metaphysical and controversial. And sixth, as long as citizens share the political conception of justice, this would not render political reasoning objectionably indeterminate. Basically, apart from number five, all others' response at best can mitigate the discrimination against religious persons. It cannot respond to the criticism of placing the asymmetrical burden on religious citizens. Furthermore, while the later on I will discuss about number five. Furthermore, while the public political institutions and non-public civil societies are two interpenetrating areas, and while the result of discussion based on different religious reasoning in civil society may penetrate into and thus influence the deliberation of formal political institutions, a state by laws, the restriction of comprehensive doctrines to be expressed in formal political institutions may also influence the atmosphere and practice of civil societies and thus depress the deliberation by using religious reasoning in civil society. People may question, why do we still allow religious reasoning in public deliberation in civil societies if it's not legitimate in political institutions? I think many examples in current public sphere, we can see such attitudes or atmosphere. As long as religious reasoning is not legitimate language in political institutions, deliberations with religious reasoning is not useful and can easily be dismissed. Indeed, some exclusivists even criticize Rawls' acceptance of religious reasoning in deliberation in civil society and allowance is in direct influence of legislation as being too inclusive, threatening the participation and consent of non-religious citizens. As Robert Audi argues, one has a prima facie obligation not to advocate or support any law or public policy unless one has and is willing to offer adequate secular reasons for this advocacy or support. Audi even demands that the secular reason must be strong enough to direct citizens' motivation of behavior independent of one's religious conviction. Robert Telsey also argues that for coercive law to be justifiable to all, it must be recommended by a reason that is accessible to all. However, strictly religious reasons are not accessible in the relevant respect. Thus, liberals consider strictly religious reasons as reasons of the wrong kind in terms of the legitimacy of law, of the laws and politics. However, if religious persons cannot split themselves into two kinds of identity, and morality cannot two kinds of identity and morality and cannot sincerely express their political viewpoints from a secular perspective because it's not based on one's own convictions, as Habermas and other accommodations have argued, to reject religious reasons in the public political forum is equivalent to reject religious persons' citizenship in liberal democracy. This violates Rawls' idea of the political conception of justice that's shared by free and equal citizens. As Habermas argues, the liberal state is to protect different forms of life in terms of a basic right, so it cannot expect citizens to justify their political statements independently of their religious convictions or worldviews. The demand is too strict. The liberal state should not transform the requirement of institutional separation of religion and politics into an extreme burden of psychological separation for religious citizens. roles, and defenders may just reply that the point five just mentions, the restriction of comprehensive doctrines is applicable to religious as well as non-religious persons. Indeed, Rawls has distinguished his idea of public reason from secular reason. According to Rawls, secular reasons and secular values are also defined as reasoning in terms of non-religious comprehensive doctrines. They are equally controversial and irreconcilable to serve the purpose of public reason. In contrast, public reason is given by principles and values of liberal political conceptions of justice that are freestanding and independent of any comprehensive doctrines. The question is the demand of public reason really fair to religious and non-religious persons? In practice, I would argue that non-religious persons will be in a more favorable position to express their opinions. This is because what Rawls refers to as public reasons in deliberations are usually language about consequences, utilities, individual rights, equalities, or explorations. It means that when non-religious persons, no matter they are hedonists, consequentialists, utilitarianists, Kantians, egalitarians, or Marxists, can still express their opinions in terms of consequence, utilities, individual rights, equality, and exploration. People would generally consider these languages as public reason without further questioning what are their underlying assumptions or their underlying comprehensive doctrines. It means that even if religious persons express their opinions based on their comprehensive doctrines, they can be easily disguised as public reasons, while religious languages, when they are expressed, are obviously religious in nature and will be automatically excluded from the public forums. Thus, although Rawls claims that his proviso is not discriminating against religious languages, in effect, non-religious persons can naturally express their opinions based on their secular comprehensive doctrines, while religious persons just cannot do that. Furthermore, I have further questions. Can Rawls' public reasons really operate independent of any comprehensive doctrines? According to Charles Taylor's moral hermeneutical phenomenology, our moral judgment of strong evaluation is inevitably based on certain shared background understandings. Taylor calls this a horizon of significance or moral framework, which incorporates a crucial set of qualitative discriminations or a set of value judgments. This is similar to what Gadamer calls prejudice. Moral language only exists and is maintained in a particular community. We learn our moral language through dialogue with those who are important to us, and thus these meanings are intersubjective meanings. What these words mean to me is what they mean to us together. Therefore, there's no such kind of moral inquiry that can be carried out without reference to the surrounding culture. Indeed, Rawls admits that our moral doctrines and judgments are on the level of religion and metaphysics. They inevitably involve comprehensive doctrines. However, Rawls emphasized that the political values are not moral doctrines. Political conceptions apply only to basic social-political institutions. They are independent of any kind of comprehensive doctrines, although they may be supported by a reasonable overlapping consensus of different comprehensive doctrines, and they are worked out from a certain liberal fundamental ideas from a constitutional regime, such as the conception of free and equal citizens and of society as a system of fair corporations. Actually, Rawls' distinction between moral and political values is consistent with what Taylor calls procedural liberalism. In Source of the Self, Taylor argues that there's an inverse trend of proceduralist move in contemporary political theory. Procedural liberalism attempts to develop norms of social justice or fairness by excluding considerations about the moral goods and qualitative discrimination from political deliberations. The motivation for proceduralism is partly epistemological. This is because the language of moral distinctions and qualitative contrast is very controversial and difficult to verify. It is the despair of reason as an arbiter of moral disputes that has driven the procedural shift to privilege certain forms of ethical reason, to control all human goals as on the same footing because they come less into dispute and or less look easier to defend in our civilization. However, through historical retrieval, Taylor argues that many contemporary conceptions of justice are motivated by Christian tradition that they seldom admit. That's why Taylor calls such procedural moral theories the ethics of inadequacy, to reject qualitative discrimination is self-defeating. It also shows us that the substantive notion of good is something inescapable in political philosophy. Rawls may reply that although the liberal conception of justice was originally motivated by Christian values, such metaphysical foundation is no longer important now. In face of fact of current pluralism, it's necessary to seek justice that's value neutral and maintain impartiality between different comprehensive doctrines. We should abandon the expectation that people support liberal institutions for the same reason. Rather, political liberalism seeks the support of an overlapping consensus. And now the political conception of the citizens as a free and equal person is already implicit in the public political culture of a democratic society. People endorse justice just for the political purpose that expresses the important political values in a liberal society. I have four criticisms of Rawls's political liberalism and the idea of public reasons. First, as Michael Sandel argues, when important moral questions are concerned, it's not always reasonable to blanket those moral values for political purpose. For instance, take the issue of abortion as an example. Whether the fetus is a human being in the case of abortion is critical to the issues. If Catholic doctrine is right, and the fetus is a real human being, then abortion is a kind of a murder. Legalizing abortion is equivalent to legalizing massacre. In such a case, it's not reasonable to blanket morality for the sake of a political agreement. And from the perspective of a Catholic, it's a double standard and hypocrisy for the US to criticize other authoritarian regimes for repressing human rights and freedom while allowing thousands of unwanted babies to be killed legally in their own country. This also shows that although people may agree with the importance of freedom and equality, their surrounding of how to define freedom and equality can be varied according to different comprehensive doctrines. To define a political conception of justice without involving any underlying metaphysical assumptions or comprehensive doctrines is just impossible. Second, as Rawls asks us to ignore or forget the underlying moral framework of political justice, Rawls' political liberalism, if it's really operated accordingly, will only maintain the status quo and leave little room for others to challenge its foundation or underlying assumptions. This is because Rawls' political liberalism claims that it has no underlying metaphysical assumptions, while in fact it does. This denial of any metaphysical foundation would hinder any further in-depth discussion and reflection about political reform and renovation in the future. While political liberalism upholds the right to freedom of speech, it ironically limits severely the kind of argument that can contribute to political debate. Third, the motivation of the use of public reason in political liberalism is to avoid dispute about morality based on different comprehensive doctrines, as we have just mentioned about. However, such motivation is really problematic, I would say. It's all of kind of an escapism. This is not really to face the reality and to deal with difficulties. It cannot provide a firm foundation of political justice. Taylor uses a story to satirize such rationality, just like a drunk who lost a key in a dark place, but he attempts to find the key under a strip lamp. People ask him why. He just say because he has more light here and it's here to find. But the key is not here, you know. So it's just to avoid the problem. It's not really to deal with the problem. Rawls may defend the reason to reject. Fourth, Rawls may defend the reason to reject his doctrines to be used in a public political forums. It's not simply that they are very controversial, but they are irreconcilable. I think the issues of moral irreconcilability is really controversial for me. Even if Rawls' thesis of moral irreconcilability is true, the problems of controversies and irreconcilability also apply to justice and other political ideas. It means that the problem of controversies is not simply about morality or value judgment. It's also in political judgments. Okay, this is shown in the current controversies of Rawls' theory of political liberalism. If we believe that we can finally arbitrate the dispute among political conceptions of justice, there's no reason to reject that we can also arbitrate the controversies among comprehensive doctrines. Thus, the assumption of the irreconcilability of comprehensive doctrines is questionable. Even if moral doctrines are really irreconcilable in the short term, substantive dialogue among different complicit doctrines at least can help to reach certain agreements of moral goods based on overlapping consensus. From the hermeneutical perspective, arguments and controversies among different moral frameworks or horizons of significance always happen in our daily life. In our daily living, we always need to read and understand the world, and we always face ideas and assumptions that are different from our own. What is needed to do is not regret it, but to study it and learn from it. The existence of moral controversies does not necessarily lead to our avoidance of moral deliberation. It can become a call for us to study other cultures substantively, so that the merging of the framework may be formed through a fusion of horizon. And that's all like my presentation. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Okay, we are going to go to the next presentation. Please stop sharing. Okay, thank you very much. And now, finally, Takuto Kobayashi from the Waseda University is going to talk about justice as fairness on the justification of political procedure. So please go ahead.
Okay, can you see the slides?
Oh. Yes.
Okay. Yes.
So thank you very much for having me here. I'm Takuto Kobayashi, a doctoral student at Waseda University, Japan. And I thank the organizing committee for making this symposium possible. And I also thank the participants in this panel session for great presentations. So my presentation today is titled Justice as Fairness on the Justification of Political Procedure. And let me just begin by explaining the background and the aim of this presentation. So justice fairness involves a defense of democratic political procedure, although it is subject to constitutional constraints and judicial review, of course. And by democracy here, I mean democracy procedurally here. I mean a political procedure that secures the equal and adequate basic political liberties, such as the freedom of speech and association and the rights to vote and run for office. And ideally speaking, democracy secures these liberties formally and also substantively by also guaranteeing the fair value of these liberties. And this is quite familiar for us law scholars. So although this much is clear, it remains unclear how we are to comparatively evaluate alternative political procedures within the theoretical framework of justice as fairness. So for example, when we are presented with alternative political procedures such as democracy versus epistocracy or democracy versus lotocracy and so on, how should we comparatively evaluate those procedures? This is the question left unanswered, I think. And these questions seem to me not fully addressed in the literature compared with the question of how to value democracy in particular, right? So many Rawls scholars have reconstructed Rawls's argument for democracy, but they do not really fully reconstruct how Rawls reaches the justification of democracy by comparison with other possible regimes. So this is problematic, I think, because several theorists now try to defend epistocracy or lotocracy or those alternatives to democracy in the literature of democratic theory. So unless we reconstruct the evaluative framework for political procedures in justice as fairness, we cannot apply justice as fairness to the ongoing disputes between democrats and epistocrats or between democrats and lotocrats and so on. So that is why I think it is necessary to reconstruct that evaluative framework of justice as fairness. So this presentation aims to reconstruct that evaluative framework. And in particular, I try to situate justice as fairness in the ongoing debate between political instrumentalism and non-instrumentalism. And my aim and my claim is that justice as fairness provides a third position, which I'm calling pluralism. Besides, I also try to illustrate how some form of epistocracy could be all things considered justifiable in the non-ideal theory of justice as fairness. So this is a table of contents, and my talk consists of five sections, which I'm going to explain in turn. So first is instrumentalism, non-instrumentalism, and pluralism. I try to define these positions without yet getting into Rawls's arguments about them. So what are political instrumentalism and non-instrumentalism? To the first approximation, they are theories about the justification or valuation of political procedure. but I prefer to call them series of procedure values because they are views about first, what properties of political procedures are relevant to the valuation of the procedure, and second, how different procedure properties are to be weighed against each other when coming into conflict. So we need answers to these questions when we try to vindicate claims of the form we ought to pursue or try to establish or maintain a political procedure P1 over another incompatible procedure, because we have to compare those procedures in terms of certain property under which those procedures can be compared. So here are some examples of procedural values or properties that are often taken to be relevant in the literature. Instrumental values include substantive reliability, by which I mean the tendency to get correct decisions, and also educational potential, the tendency to improve knowledge or character of citizens. Non-instrumental values include political equality and political autonomy. The political equality is a property of guaranteeing everyone an equal influence, roughly speaking. And political autonomy means something like guaranteeing everyone some absolute influence over political decisions. So this is how I understand those different procedural properties. And so for instance, we might say that given this variety of procedural values, we might say, for instance, procedure one is pro tanto better than procedure two because procedure one distributes voting rights more equally than procedure two. Or we might say a pro tanto procedure one is better than two because procedure one is better in terms of substantive reliability than procedure two. So there are many dimensions of a comparison between different procedures and what property is relevant and how different properties are to be weighed against each other are the important questions for the theories of political justification of political procedure. So there are four basic positions in this regard. One is pure instrumentalism, which says that only some instrumental values are relevant. This position, I think, is supported by Richard Arneson for quite long. And also Jason Brennan might be another theorist who is endorsing this view on the justification of political procedure. And another is pure non-instrumentalism, which says that only some non-instrumental values are relevant. And there are also hybrid versions. A hybrid instrumentalism says both instrumental and non-instrumental values are relevant, but a certain instrumental value is categorically superior to any non-instrumental ones, by which that is to say the instrumental value is not outweighed by any non-instrumental values. So for example, one might say that political equality might matter, but if benevolent dictatorship is substantively more reliable than democracy, then we must choose benevolent dictatorship, one might say, for example. So this is hybrid instrumentalism. And by contrast, non-instrumentalism says both instrumental and non-instrumental values are relevant, but a certain non-instrumental value is categorically superior to any instrumental ones. So one might say even if benevolent dictatorship is substantively more reliable than democracy, we should never compromise political equality that is established in democracy for that reason. So I think this is the most popular position among defenders of democracy, such as Thomas Cristiano, and Nico Colodoni, for example, and this is how I view the existing positions in the literature. And the point I want to make here is that there could be a fifth position, which I call pluralism. It says that first, relevant procedural values include both instrumental and non-instrumental ones, and second, a pair of some cardinal instrumental and non-instrumental values enjoy symmetry, that is to say, there is no categorical superiority or inferiority between them. And my basic claim in this presentation is that justice of fairness is a version of pluralism in this sense. So how do I try to vindicate this claim? I think it's fairly clear that justice of fairness is neither purely instrumentalist nor purely non-instrumentalist, because justice of fairness clearly agrees or argues that both political equality and the substantive reliability and also educational potentials are important. So it includes both instrumental and non-instrumental values as relevant. So in the main parts of this presentation, I will criticize the interpretation of justice as fairness as hybrid instrumentalism or hybrid non-instrumentalism. And this is what I'm going to do in sections 3 and 4. But before going into that, I should briefly say something about what it means to comparatively evaluate political procedures in justice as fairness. Basically, I take it to mean choosing between alternative principles for the distribution of the basic political liberties. So in justice fairness, the parties in the original position and later in the constitutional convention address how the basic political liberties should be distributed. And it seems that the second stage, constitutional convention, is as important as the original position, because principles governing the distribution of particular political liberties seem to be finalized in this second stage. So how should we distribute, for example, the voting rights or right to run for office, or the freedom of speech or association, and those particular liberties and the principles governing the distribution of those particular liberties are finalized in this second stage, not just in the original position. So then, here's a guiding question. How should the parties in the constitutional convention evaluate alternative such principles, given that different such principles would make political procedure that apply them have various procedural values to different degrees? What procedural values should the parties deem relevant, and how should the parties weigh those values against each other? So this is the guiding question. And this question, these questions invite various interpretations. And in the next section, I will criticize a hybrid non-instrumentalist interpretation. So this is a section three. So first of all, there's textual evidence that Rawls indeed regards political equality quite important. Rawls submits a principle of equal participation, which says that, quote, all citizens are to have an equal right to take part in and to determine the outcomes of the constitutional process that establishes the laws with which they are to comply, end of quote. So Rawls suggests that, the parties in the constitutional convention agree on this principle as the best interpretation of the first principle of justice. But the question is whether there is a hybrid non-instrumentalist argument for this principle. There are two candidate arguments we can find in the literature. One is something which might be called a mirroring argument. This is that political procedure should structurally resemble to the original position. And this is something Rawls immediately says after introducing the principle of participation. But unfortunately, because due to the time limitation, I have to skip this one, because this seems to be much weaker than the second argument, which I'm reconstructing from now on, argument from a sense of justice and self-respect. And this is the argument which this secondary scholars really focus on when reconstructing Rawls's argument. So I'm roughly following Meena Krishnamurthy's reconstruction of the argument, and the argument proceeds as follows. But to begin with, citizens have a higher order interest in developing and exercising a sense of justice, and this requires institutional means, which is the equal basic liberties. And also, citizens have an interest in maintaining their self-respect, which include their confidence in the ability to exercise a sense of justice. So this requires institutions to express respect for citizens as moral agents who have a sense of justice. And the expression of such respect requires equal political liberties. So these two lines of arguments are taken to support the equal political liberties together. And it seems that Rawls's point in making these arguments is to vindicate the priority of liberty in the first place, or the priority of satisfying the first principle of justice to any other principles or values. And if this is successful, then it is the very strength of the argument. The political equality may be categorically superior to substantive reliability regarding the production of outcomes that fulfill the second principle of justice or any other outcomes that realize any other social values, right? So it might appear that the categorical superiority of political equality might seem established by this argument. But my objection is as follows. The idea here is that there is no single conception of substantive reliability, right? We can work out various conceptions of it, each indexed to a particular range of outcomes. And one conception relevant here is a substantive reliability regarding the protection of the basic civil liberties, as listed here, the protection of liberties of thought and conscience, physical, psychological integrity of the person, and rights covered by the rule of law. So alternative political procedure can be comparatively evaluated instrumentally in terms of their respective tendencies to protect the basic liberties via their outcomes or substantive laws, for example. So if substantive reliability is defined in this way, then the equal political liberties don't seem categorically superior to it. And I think this thought is actually reflected on Rawls's writings, in particular his remark about John Stuart Mill's plural voting scheme. Rawls says that the scheme, quote, may be perfectly just, end quote, but only if its justification appeals to its substantive reliability in protecting the scheme of basic liberties of the least politically advantaged. And this seems to leave room for the justifiability of aristocracy insofar as we regard Mill's plural voting scheme as aristocratic. So this is the basic objection to the hybrid non-instrumentalist interpretation. And going on to the hybrid instrumentalist interpretation, I think this interpretation is proposed by Stephen Wall. He proposes a subordination thesis, according to which the political liberties are less intrinsically valuable than civil liberties. So Stephen Wall tries to defend this claim within the Rawlsian framework. Now, this is similar to the well-known objection which Jürgen Habermas once raised against Rawls. And Rawls tried to respond by saying that political and civil liberties are equally valuable because they are co-original, meaning that both liberties are normatively rooted in the two moral powers, a sense of justice and capacity for conception of good. And both are necessary for the adequate development and exercise of those powers. But Wall claims that two things co-originality doesn't entail their equal value. And he doesn't extensively argue for this claim, but he provides some apparent evidence that Rawls's justice of fairness in fact accepts the subordination thesis. The evidence is Rawls's sympathetic comment on Mill's plural voting scheme, which we saw earlier. So Stephen Wall's idea seems to be that if equality of political liberty can be compromised to protect civil liberties, as in the Mill's plural voting scheme, then the equal political liberties must be less valuable than civil liberties. So this is, I think Wall's interpretation of Rawls's position. But I think Wall's view is unnecessarily strong. The question is whether the subordination thesis is necessary to make Rawls's remark about the plural voting scheme coherent, but it's not necessary, I think. In fact, even if political and civil liberties are equally valuable, plural voting scheme could be justified if its compromise of the equal political liberties is a necessary cost to realize the maximal feasible protection of the total scheme of basic liberties. So this is my view. And I think this view is more plausible than Stephen Wall's view, because if we followed Stephen Wall's view, we would have to accept that any piecemeal improvement to the basic civil liberties would be sufficient to justify whatever extent of inequality in political liberties. But that is not very plausible. Mill's plural voting scheme would be all things considered justified over equal voting scheme only when its improvement on the civil liberties is significant enough to countervail its damage to political equality. So I think Wall's hybrid instrumentalist interpretation is not well supported either. So this is my objection to the hybrid instrumentalist interpretation. So based on these negative observations, I'm attracted to a pluralist interpretation of justice as fairness. So in this final section, I will briefly elaborate on this interpretation. So to repeat, this interpretation says two things. First, both the equality of the basic political liberties and substantive reliability regarding the protection of basic civil liberties are included in relevant procedural values. And second, neither procedural property is categorically superior to the other. But notice that this pluralist claim belongs only to the non-ideal theory of justice as fairness, because this claim presupposes that basic political and civil liberties could come into conflict. Otherwise, there would be no point in claiming that they have equal value. But ideal theory of justice as fairness rejects this presupposition. Rawls writes that the ideal theory assumes, quote, the most central application of each liberty can be simultaneously secured, end of quote. So pluralism belongs to the non-ideal theory, and of course the justifiability of aristocracy such as Mill's plural voting scheme also belongs to the non-ideal theory. And I think this point is important because justice as fairness always imposes some constraints and directions on non-ideal theory. So I will conclude by giving a rough outline of non-ideal justification of aristocracy within justice as fairness. So beginning with constraints, one crucial question for epistocrats is how to define competence, because people's competence gap is a necessary premise for epistocrats. But my point has been that equality of political liberties can be compromised only for the sake of significantly greater substantive reliability regarding the protection of the basic civil liberties. So though there may be various conceptions of political competence, only those conceptions relevant to the protection of the basic civil liberties are available to epistocrats, at least within justice and fairness. So this is a constraint on the definition of political competence that is necessary for the justification of epistocracy. And finally, this is the final slide, directions for non-ideal theory. Another noteworthy point made by Rawls himself is that when we introduce unequal basic liberties in non-ideal circumstances, quote, we must, however, make sure that the course of change being followed is such that social conditions will eventually be brought about under which restrictions on these freedoms are no longer justified, end of quote. So applying this remark to the question about justifiability of epistocracy, my interpretation is this. Epistocracy like Mill's plural voting scheme could be justifiable, but only if there is large enough competence gap in the relevant sense, and also there is prospect for the epistocratic arrangement to contribute to diminishing the competence gap itself. In other words, epistocracy must tend to eliminate unfavorable conditions only upon which the epistocracy itself is rendered justifiable. So this is a constraint just as fairness imposes upon the justifiability of epistocracy within its theoretical framework. So to briefly conclude, just as fairness is theoretically open to epistocracy's justifiability, but it has various constraints and directions about how it could be justified, even in non-ideal theory. And this seems to be the implication which justice as fairness has for the ongoing issues about the standards for justification of political procedures, a comparison between democracy and epistocracy, and so on. And this is my overall point. So here is the reference list, and that is all for me. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Takuto Kobayashi. Thank you very much to all you three. Now it's time for the discussion, and let's see if there is any question here from the attendees. By the attendees, no question. Okay. Okay, Lucas, please go ahead.
Thank you, Andrew, and thank you, Takuto. It was very interesting to also hear more about the side of Rawls's thought. Takuto, I had one basic question, one clarificatory question to you. You speak about non-ideal theory, but I don't really understand, or I don't really know what kind of non-ideal circumstances are relevant in the context of discussing democracy. Is it lack of knowledge of certain kind of citizens, or what kind of non-ideal world are we speaking here?
Okay, thank you. Sorry about this relatively unclear specification of non-ideal circumstances in my presentation, but basically, as you say, it is the kind of knowledge gap or deficiency in political knowledge of citizens. Things like political knowledge about who the candidates are, what the proposed policies are, all those things. And these, like the deficiencies in knowledge of these kinds is recently, or for several decades, I think, insisted on by various empirical literature on political knowledge and political rationality in rationality in political discourse. So, for example, in recent years, Christopher Aiken and Larry Bartels published the book Democracy for Realists, in which they summarize the decades of empirical studies in the political incompetence, ignorance, and irrational belief formation of citizens. And I have in mind those empirical studies as non-ideal circumstances. Yes.
Please, Andrew.
I have a question for Lucas. Based on my understanding of your presentation, you think that economic growth is the best way to achieve difference principles. And you have mentioned about the right-wing Rawlsian, the growth driven by market. However, you think that it's better to endorse a state-led growth because the meaningful economic growth is the innovation growth, right? I mean, it's best way to achieve innovation growth by state, right? I have two questions. First of all, I don't know. I mean, you know, I am a Hong Kong people. I mean, I'm a Chinese. You know, China is very much, the growth in mainland China is very much state-led. I mean, how do you think about this? Are you thinking about the state-led is growth is kind of a China model? On the other hand, it is exactly the most controversial. I mean, you say that the welfare can secure the basic need and basic security for the citizens, and it is the best way for them to enjoy the innovations or to benefit from the from those innovations. However, you know, usually welfare states, in particular, a good welfare will usually be criticized by those right-wing people saying that it seems to discourage people to work. I mean, discourage, let's say recently, Joe Biden's unemployment benefits, many people will criticize the benefits too good for, they are really secure and they have no motivation to find a job. And it seems to, you know, to obstruct the economic growth. So how would you respond from this right-wing criticism of a welfare state or state-led growth, economic growth? Thank you.
Thank you so much for these fantastic questions. They give me the opportunity to clarify a few things. So the question about China, mainland China, is a very tricky one whenever you raise it in political philosophy. I don't know whether I want to fully endorse state-led growth on a sort of personal level. The paper that I presented is more a response to these right-wing authors, the right-wing Rawlsians. And I want to show that they shouldn't be too sure about what the conclusions, what the implications of their own arguments are. I think if you adduce these empirical arguments, you arrive at very different conclusions. I think when we think about how to structure political economy, it's not just growth that we should have in mind, but also other things, especially sustainability and so on. There are real questions as to the compatibility of growth and other values. And I guess these are also some questions that I would raise in the case of China. There are very obvious political philosophical questions you have to raise in this context, but you might think that in the case of China, it's not just growth that is required, but other values that, you know, require economic change, economic transformation, but perhaps growth in this model that we had isn't really what we need. So I'm trying to get away from your question, but yeah, when it comes to the mere political economy, there are some things that don't seem too absurd. You know, this role of the state through state-owned enterprises, for example, is something that we could have more of in Europe, you might think. But there are many other things that I don't want to subscribe to. So I want to be very cautious here. When it comes to the welfare state, I wanted to give a different, open a different debate when for the welfare state. Usually the debate on the welfare state is the one that you sketched. On the other hand, to say that the welfare state is the provides citizens with their basic needs. And on the other hand, you say, well, it discourages people to work. If there is no welfare state, people work harder, and so we don't even need a welfare state. With this argument that I gave from Carlota Perez in the case of streets and social insurance, I wanted to highlight that the welfare state in itself can play an important economic role in channeling and driving growth. this whole discouraging argument, I think there are a couple of ways of rejecting that. The most obvious way for me would be to say that many people want meaningful employment, and so there is always a, you know, there will always be enough people to take on jobs. But I don't have a more systematic answer to that. Did I answer your questions? And yeah, for the mainland China question, that's a very difficult one for me.
Yes, it's not easy. Yeah. To a certain extent, I think this is always the dilemma between equality and liberty. If you want to achieve certain equality, you certainly will bring certain restriction on individual liberty, and it may to a certain extent involve certain or interference in the market, I would say. To a certain extent, I think the growth in China is really stated, and you can see the, in particular, you know, Huawei, although it claims to be a private enterprise, but many people would think that it is really get a great support from the government. Otherwise, it is impossible for it to grow so fast. And technologically, I mean, so to a certain extent, if you say, you talk about innovation growth, I mean, state innovation growth, I really see this is a China model as an example, but it will also bring us certain, let's say, political the issues about political liberalism, and they may be rejected by liberals too, I mean. So I think it's, yeah, that's what I just think about.
maybe I can just have one clarificatory sentence. So I'm a liberal in the sense that I think that, you know, if we speak in Walter's term, the fair the liberties, civic liberties are the first principle. I think these have to come first, and so I tend to speak much rather about European or American instances of, you know, previous cycles of growth, like the 50s and 60s, that are often celebrated as such. But when it comes to the political economy, there are real questions whether, you know, there's not also things to understand and learn from the Chinese context. But I focus much rather on the European context because I understand it a bit better. So thank you for the question.
Okay, thanks.
It seems there are no more questions. Okay, here we have. Takuto Kobayashi.
Yeah, thank you. I have a question for Lucas, and I'm wondering whether Jason Brennan or other right-wing Rosians say anything about what happens to the fair value of political liberties in their preferred scenario of growth and the less fair capitalism. Because Rawls emphasizes that the difference principle doesn't operate in isolation from the other principles of justice. So I think that the right question is, what is the best strategy to meet the difference principle, but rather the right question is, what is the best strategy to meet the difference principle in a way compatible with the prior principles of justice? So if laissez faire capitalism kind of undermines the fair value of political liberties too much, then that might be a sufficient reason to reject to those regimes within the Rawlsian framework. So was that argumentative strategy effective in your opinion?
Absolutely, and this is also in the region of Rawls's own rejection of capitalism and welfare state capitalism. So John Tomasi, who is this other author that I mentioned, he argues that growth is leads to an environment where people are open to new ideas and have the ability to try out new things. And he also cites and relies on a political economist called Benjamin Friedman, who spells out this argument that whenever you had high levels of tolerance in society, there was also growth. And so what we see as narrow economic growth and these values that he thinks are very important in order to realize liberties, they always occur in tandem, they always occur together. These publications are a bit old by now. It's the main book is from 2007 from Benjamin Friedman, but there is some more underlying thinking going on why this and also the equality of opportunities would be compatible with growth. I should say that you're completely right that, of course, the difference principle comes last in the ordering, and that a premise of my argument is that the other two principles have already been satisfied, and so it doesn't matter anymore what the impact is of state-led growth or any kind of growth to these others. So the idea is that now only we've reached that stage of deliberation where only the difference principle is open. If you're interested in that, I'm happy to send you the exact place in Tomasi's book and also the Benjamin Friedman book, who is more a political economist making that argument.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Andrew, you have your hand raised, but maybe it's the last one, the last intervention. Well, I suppose so. Okay. Well.
Sorry. No. I forget to.
Okay. No problem. Well, I have a question for Lucas. Well, we are asking questions to Lucas today. It's about the a non-ideal circumstance about growth that, in fact, it has to do with sustainability. You have already said something about it, but I am very concerned about the ecological problem and the need for boundaries to growth, and maybe I don't know what's your position about it, but maybe this claim, this Rawlsian claim about meal, the stationary society, maybe could be a good argument to make to make compatible the theory of justice and at the same time the environmental sustainability. What do you think about it?
Fantastic, thank you very much. And I agree with you that there's a real concern here. My opponents here, the right-wing Rawlsians, they just assume that the kind of growth that they want to see will be firstly distributed equally among the different income groups, which you might think is controversial, and that it is sustainable, so that it is within the limits of the resources of the planet. And that is part of my PhD project, as is this paper, but it goes beyond this paper. I think we have to, my overall project is on this idea of state entrepreneurship. And this chapter that I presented today is on growth. But I think there are different ways how you can think about the consequences of state entrepreneurship, the state producing innovation, new technology, and introducing them into the market. And this idea of state entrepreneurship, we can take it a bit more fine grain. So instead of just growth, a better economy, we could think of new markets that make it more likely that people live in an environmentally friendly way. So for example, you might think that the introduction of electric vehicles into the market represents an economic change that, that's growth, it's new product, it's new money, you might think, but that's not the interesting part of, about it. It changes the economy in a way that we have new markets that have value to society because it's, we as a society may be able to live more sustainably, and individuals are able to do so too. So I think I'm arguing that we can tackle sustainability through state entrepreneurship. I think these are key, how that relates to growth is a different question, and I'm aware of the idea of the stationary economy, or nowadays no growth or degrowth, but often they imply that we live in a stationary economy where there are no dynamic changes anymore. And I think these rapid economic changes, new technologies being introduced, destroying others, or making others obsolete, I think that's one of the strongest economic forces that we have at our disposal. And through the idea of state entrepreneurship, we might be able to use it in this way. So you might be aware of Joseph Schumpeter's idea of creative destruction. The iPhone comes, Nokia phones become obsolete within a couple of years. That is a very strong economic force. And the hope is that we can use it actively in order to move towards a sustainable economy. But as you will have noticed, this goes away from the discourse and the understanding of growth as I used it in this paper, which I mentioned is mostly a response to these authors who themselves do not engage so much with the sustainability question. I hope that answered the question.
Thank you very much. No, I knew that my question wasn't exactly about your answers to these right-wing Rawlsians, but anyway, I am very interested in that subject, and I wanted to ask you this question, and I am very satisfied with the answer, so thank you very much. Okay, let's see if there is another question. No more questions. Okay. No more questions. Well, we are on time. Just 3 minutes to half past one. So thank you very much for your presentations, and we are very pleased to have had you here. And good luck in your research.
Thank you very much for time and the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.